and Coffey was 22. Kevin Lowe had a theory that every full playoff season you play adds an extra year to your life, like doggy years. And in 1984, the Islanders were battle-worn. They'd gone through to the finals for 5 years straight. Their goalie, Billy Smith, was one of the oldest guys on both teams. He was 33. To call him a competitor would be an understatement. A year earlier, in Game 1, we outshot the Islanders 35-24, and yet they won 2-0 on an empty net goal. Billy did not fit the Islander mold, and in some respects, that helped balance things out. He was on the wild side, which took them to another level. There's an old biblical saying, an angry man stirs up fights, and that's what Billy did. We were in wars with him throughout the entire season and the playoffs. If he had the chance, he'd cut your head off. He didn't even pretend he wasn't trying to hurt you if you came near him. I was particularly focused on Billy because I knew he would have loved to bring me to my knees. He hated me, and I didn't like him. Today, though, we have a mutual respect. I know how good he was and how much he wanted to win. Besides Ron Hextall, he was probably the best goaltender I ever played against. Each of them could wield his stick pretty good to protect his crease. Billy was fearless, too. I remember seeing him jawing with Dave Semenko and wondering, what could Smith be saying to Semenko? And more importantly, what was Dave saying back? Whatever it was, I'm sure it was witty and mean. But in general, tough guys don't get enough credit for being funny. It takes a special kind of coolness to come up with good one-liners in the heat of battle. A lot of people don't know this, but during the 9-day break after we beat the Minnesota North Stars to make it into the final against the Islanders in 1984, Roger Nielsen had just been released by Vancouver. He was a good hockey man and a very creative thinker, so Glenn hired him as our first video coach. Very few teams used video back then, but Roger spent his entire career trying to find ways to win. In the early 70s, before he started coaching in the NHL, Roger was coaching for the Peterborough Petes, as I mentioned earlier. If there was a penalty shot against his team, he'd put a defenseman in net. When the shooter picked up the puck, the defenseman would charge out. As a result, a rule was established that you had to have a goalie in net on a penalty shot. Roger once pulled his goalie when the faceoff was in his own end. The puck dropped, a forward stepped on the ice and skated to the red line, and the guy taking the faceoff passed it up ice for a breakaway. So, again, because of Roger, there's now a rule that requires you to have all six guys on the ice unless there's a penalty. Glenn Sather never tried to snuff out our creativity, but he wanted to review the tapes and watch what was going on. Interestingly, the Islanders were doing then what a lot of teams do now, collapsing into the slot on defense. All five Islanders would protect the middle in front of their own net. They would let you wheel around the perimeter all night, passing back and forth and taking bad angle shots. Then they would grab the rebound and go the other way. You can't pass if no one is open, so it was really hard for us to make the kind of plays we were used to making. We were such a good skating, passing team. So we'd try it anyway, and we'd just end up turning the puck over, and they'd go back on a 2-on-1. Our new game plan for the finals was to take the puck wide, take the shot, and have guys driving to the net. We weren't supposed to try to make any plays in the slot. The coaching staff said, "Forget trying for beautiful plays. Don't even bother looking in the slot until we're safely ahead and if the Islanders have broken down trying to score. Then, if you outman them, obviously make a play." The Islanders were a really businesslike team. They had every element, skill, smarts, and some really tough guys, but they weren't bullies. The Flyers were bullies, and the Bruins were bullies, or tried to be. The islanders were like Wall Street. They were like a corporation. Everything was in place. Everyone had their job. We knew that passing was a huge part of their game, but the video helped us with their patterns. Roger's videos were like that. The thing about going up against championship teams like the Islanders is that they've got great forwards you have to defend against, tough defensemen you've got to get through, and then a top goalie you have to outmaneuver. They could beat you offensively and defensively, and they could beat you up. They had it all. We did too, but they were a dynasty team, and once you win, you know what it takes to win. People always say to me, who was the hardest player to play against? Who was the best defenseman? There were a lot of good defensemen I played against. Among them, Larry Robinson, Ray Bourque, and Brian Leetch. And the Islanders had a Kim Claxon-type player named Gordy Lane who was flat-out dirty. So I didn't like being out there with him. You never knew what he was going to do. But I have to say that Dennis Potvin was the hardest. I played every shift against him, Butch Goring, and Bob Bourne. Matchups were a big part of the NHL, and still are. I was always conscious of where he was on the ice, because he'd be looking to run the crap out of you. I even knew when he was drinking Gatorade on the bench. That's how closely I watched him. He wasn't dirty, but he was mean. Very mean. I say that in a hockey way, not in a bad way. He used to like to step up at the blue line, and he'd either stick his big hip out or lay his shoulder into you. He didn't want to let you get any momentum. It was like running into a parked car. They really outplayed us in game one. But we won it 1-0 because goaltender Grant Fuhr stood on his head and they couldn't score. As well, the video had shown us where to be when the Islanders moved the puck, so we were able to constantly intercept their passes. For instance, Brent Sutter and Kevin McClelland took a face-off to the right of Billy Smith. Sutter won the draw for the Islanders, but our left winger, Dave Hunter, followed him into the corner. Pat Hughes picked up the loose puck and passed it over to McClelland. Glenn always preached, hit the net with a quick release. And sure enough, it worked in that situation. McClelland was a guy brought in to provide some grit up front, and he ended up with a game-winning goal. Teams love it when guys like that score big goals. In fact, Kevin chipped in a lot that spring. But Grant was the hero that night. He turned away 34 shots to become the first goalie since the great Frank McCool in 1945 to get a shutout in his first Stanley Cup final game. Grant would never complain about the fact that he was often left alone to fend for himself defensively. And yet without him, we wouldn't have won. Because we'd shut out the Islanders in their own building, we had a lot of confidence. We thought, oh, things are going to be different this year. And then they beat us 6-1 in game two. I sat next to Lee Fogelin for the 5-hour flight back from Long Island that night, and I don't think we said two words to each other. We all had this, oh man, it's going to happen again, feeling of dread. The next day we called a lunch at this little dive in downtown Edmonton called SWAT Headquarters, where we all went for pickled eggs and draft beer and to shoot pool. You could feel the intensity level. Everyone had it in their eyes. We were not going to let them beat us like last year. Mark Messier could lift the team up on his shoulders sometimes. In the second period of Game 3, Clark Gillies scored to put the Islanders ahead 2-1. Then came a turning point. Lee Fogelin was on the blue line when the puck floated back to him. Mess came back and circled, and Lee just pushed it to him. Mess spun around, headed down the boards, cut across, skated around their defenseman, Gord Dineen, and then put it in on goalie Billy Smith's stick side. It was a great goal. And not only did it regenerate our bench and our crowd, but it also seemed to deflate the Islanders. We ended up winning that game 7-2, In the dressing room afterward, Kenny Linsemann said, "Once Mark smelled victory, man, it was over." Near the end of Game 3, Grant got banged up in a collision with Pat LaFontaine outside the net. Back then, the rules were, hit the goalie, no big deal. Grant had also been nursing a sore shoulder, and the hit made it a lot worse. Andy stepped in for the last 8 minutes. The next day, when we headed to the rink, everyone was wondering, is Grant going to be healthy enough to play? Once we got there, it was pretty evident that he wasn't. But we couldn't let that information out to the Islanders, so we kept it quiet until game time. Andy Moog didn't like getting wound too tight. He thought his energy might take him all over the place, and then he'd over-challenge in the net or go way outside the crease and overhandle the puck. We knew he needed to relax and settle into his game, so we were pretty low-key with him. It was a, how do you feel? Are you ready to go? Let's get it done, sort of thing. Very much another day at the office kind of attitude. We took game 4 with the same score, 7-2. Andy was still in goal for game 5. He was so steady and focused. You've got to have goaltending or you're not going to lift the Stanley Cup. No one was saying much once we got out on the ice for game 5. Conversations were really brief. We had to stay in the moment because the Northlands was becoming unglued. Then, with a couple minutes to go, we scored, making it 5-2 for us. I started looking around and seeing the faces, and that's when I realized it was real. It was going to happen. That may be my best Stanley Cup memory. That feeling of, I don't want to call it relief, but joy and pride. Hockey is a team game, so when you win the cup, you share the win. Throughout the season, you've shared some of the heartaches and disappointments and have come through it all together. If you ask anyone who's won a Stanley Cup, they'll tell you that it's the ultimate team accomplishment. Everybody has to participate. It's not like other sports where some of the best players play 3/4 of the game. Every guy on the team has to play his heart out. It's a great trophy. For years, out of all the major championships in North America, it was the only trophy that was presented to the players themselves. When a trophy was won in other sports, it was handed to the owner. But when the Stanley Cup is won, it's handed to the players, and it's always been that way. I picked it up and hoisted it. I didn't realize how heavy it was, and it started to roll forward, but the guys had my back. We made it our goal at the start of the 1984-85 season to win the cup again, and to prove that beating the Islanders hadn't been a fluke. And it wasn't. We were on a roll. We swept the Kings and the Jets, and closed out the Blackhawks in 6. We met the Flyers in the final. Philadelphia was a great team, full of guys who just didn't give up. Brian Propp was one of their top scorers. Brian and I are good friends today, but back then he'd just started this thing called the guffaw, which he'd learned from watching comic Howie Mandel. After a goal, Brian would go down on one knee, take his glove off, and flip his hand in the air. It drove us nuts. We wanted to chop his hand off every time he did it. They also had the Sutter brothers, Richie and his twin Ronnie, along with Dave Poulin, Mark Howe, Derek Smith, Brad Marsh, Dave Brown, Tim Kerr, Peter Zezel, Brad McCrimmon, and a great young Swedish goalie named Pelle Lindberg. The Flyers dictated the first game and beat us 4-1. Glenn Sather was so steamed by the way we played that he burned the game tapes after he watched them. We got the message and took the next 3 games. In game 5, we were ready to bring the series to an end. Grant Fuhr played phenomenally well. He'd kept us in through the first round against LA, and in the finals against Philadelphia, he made some critical saves. Paul Coffey had an incredible series too. In the final, he scored back-to-back goals, which took us into the second period with a huge advantage, up 4-1. What most people didn't know was that Paul had injured his foot and his hip in the semifinals against Winnipeg. And yet he wound up with 12 goals, 36 points in the playoffs, breaking Bobby Orr's and Brad Park's record of 9 playoff goals for a defenseman. I won the Conn Smythe, but both Paul and Grant could have easily been picked instead. I remember Peter Pocklington saying that winning the cup again was like having a second child. We didn't make it to the final the next year, though. Calgary had our number, and went on to meet Montreal in the final. The Habs rode a young Patrick Waugh to victory in the first all-Canadian Stanley Cup matchup since the 1967 expansion. We came back in 1986-87, determined to bring the cup home to Edmonton. Meanwhile, the Flyers had called up Ron Hextall from the Hershey Bears. He was a big goalie, 6'3", who had a mean streak. In his rookie season, he'd been the first goaltender to get more than 100 penalty minutes. Ron was great at moving the puck. You just didn't see that back then. In December 1987, against Boston, he became the second NHL goalie ever to score a goal. Billy Smith was the first against Colorado in 1979, but it was on a deflection. In the following year's semifinals against Washington, Ron did it again. They pulled their goalie, and he shot it in the net. Ron Hextall was good for the Flyers, and he was good for us. I can't say we went into the finals complacent, but we were a little laid back. And it was Ron's fire that made us hate them. Hate can be a great motivator. For example, in Game 4, we were ahead 4-1. Glenn Anderson used his stick on Ron's pad to free up a puck. And seconds later, when Kent Nielsen skated by the net, Ron got him in the back of the leg with a two-hander that cost him 8 games at the start of the next season. Ron's intensity helped the Flyers overachieve and take us to 7 games, and we used it to win the cup. Hextall won the Conn Smythe that year. Not to take anything away from him, he played tremendously and kept them in the series, but when the losing goalie wins the MVP, it tells you that his team was pretty badly outplayed. That was something people never said about Grant Fuhr. He was incredible in net. To me, Grant was the greatest goalie who ever played. But in 1987, something that seems to happen to all dynasties began happening to us. We started losing players. When Paul Coffey and Glenn couldn't come to terms on a new contract, Paul sat out for the first 21 games of the season and was traded to Pittsburgh. We also lost Andy Moog. Andy was tired of being Grant Fuhr's automatic backup. He wanted to play. He decided to sit out and took the opportunity to play for the Canadian Olympic team, and eventually played 5 seasons for Boston and 4 for Dallas. We'd come off 3 cups in 4 years. We knew we were a good team. Meanwhile, Boston was coming off a very good series, having beaten the Montreal Canadiens in the Stanley Cup playoffs for the very first time. To me, that's still one of the most shocking stats in the history of hockey. I mean, think of the great teams with Milt Schmidt and Johnny Busick, and then of course with Esposito and Orr. We had fully expected to meet either Boston or Montreal in the final. The good news was that we knew our experience would be a big advantage. The Bruins were going to be in the same situation we were in 83 against the Islanders. The bad news was that our record as a team and as individuals was just absolutely horrible in the Boston Garden. Look at our stats. From 79 to 88, only 2 wins over a 9-year period. Part of that was the effect of the small ice surface there. We were a skating team, and the Bruins were experts at using their rink to take away time and space. But the other thing to keep in mind was that every time we played Boston during the season, we'd be on the tail end of a 5 or 6 game road trip. We might play Buffalo Thursday night, Philly Saturday, and Boston Sunday. We were professionals, so we couldn't make excuses. But it was a factor. So we were thinking, hey, they haven't seen the real Edmonton Oilers. We're going to play the first 2 games at home and then fly to Boston where we're going to have a nice skate and a practice. We'll be comfortable and rested and ready to play. Not that we took them lightly. They had Ray Bourque, Craig Janney, and Cam Neely, who was a lot like Clark Gillies. And speaking of guys who were no fun to play against, Ken Linsemann was now with the Bruins. And in net for the Bruins, Andy Moog. We played really well in the first 2 games in Edmonton. The hockey world had anticipated that Boston would be better than us at defense. It was their strength, after all. And so everyone was surprised at how strong we were in our own end. In Game 1, we held them to 14 shots and won 2-1. Game 2, we held them to 12 shots and won 4-2. Now we were heading to Boston for Game 3. And because of our record there, everyone figured that the tide would turn. What people didn't know was that Glenn and John Muckler had us watching videos of their games so we could see what we needed to do on a smaller ice surface, how we were going to break out of a smaller neutral zone, how the wingers had to be more tentative and stay back instead of getting ahead of the play. In those days, you couldn't make a two-line pass out of your zone. So the guard in small neutral zone meant that we had to be more patient as a group and come up together. But the biggest factor was what to do with Ray Bourque. Ray Bourque was the key on defense. Everybody in the National Hockey League said one thing. When you play Boston, don't dump it to Ray Bourque. Keep the puck away from Ray Bourque. Glenn and John said, let's do the opposite. Go ahead and dump the puck to Ray Bourque, because he's going to move it to his partner, and we can get on that guy. So for 5 days, at every practice, one of our young defensemen would come out in a number 7 jersey. Someone even put it on his helmet, and we'd practice dumping the puck to Ray. We had it down to a science. We went into Game 3 and started working our strategy, and I think it caught them off guard. For years and years, teams had dumped the puck to the other corner, and now all of a sudden they had to figure out how to handle our new system. Physically, our guys simply wore Ray down. They just dumped it into his corner and pounded him, and we had a big team. Meanwhile, up front, we played Steve Smith against Cam Neely, every shift. Cam was becoming the best player in the Eastern playoffs. A bull. He was fearless and could score 60 goals. But Steve Smith was a big, strong guy, too. Steve and Cam battled toe-to-toe for 4.5 games. Steve did a great job on him. My good friend Ace Bailey had a buddy who owned a restaurant bar in Boston called Three Cheers. I said, Ace, let's set up a party after Game 4. Food, hors d'oeuvres, champagne. We've got about 80 people. During the playoffs, we'd normally have a team meal back at the hotel where they'd set up a buffet. Our families would be there because, as I've said, Glenn was really good about that. Looking back, I understand why he did it. It put the players at ease. When you play and your family comes out, you can't help worrying, okay, where's my mom and dad going to eat tonight? Where are we going to go after the game? Glenn took away that worry. In Game 4, with about 8 minutes left in the second period, Craig Simpson scored to tie it 3-3. And then all the lights went out. It was pitch black on the ice. After about 10 minutes, one of the older guys, I can't remember who, said, power isn't coming back on. This game is over. I thought, over? How can it be over? We went back to the locker room, and everyone was quiet. When we got on the bus, I said, well, we have to go to Three Cheers. We've got all this stuff. and so the whole team went over to Congress Street by Boston Harbor. We were still in disbelief. We ate the buffalo wings and onion rings and potato skins, and everyone had a few beers and some wine, but no one was celebrating. It wasn't as if we'd lost, so no one was upset. It was more like, okay, now what? I've been through a lot of things in professional sports and amateur sports, and I've never seen anything like it. What was even more amazing was that while we were still sitting in the locker room wondering what to do, we watched NHL President John Ziegler on CBC. He was standing in a corner of Boston Garden holding the rule book. There were a ton of reporters surrounding him. Ziegler had found a bylaw on the books from the 1920s that said if the lights go off and they can't come back on, the game will be replayed in its entirety. There was to be a game 5, 6, 7, and 8 if necessary. And all the individual statistics from the game would count. It was all mapped out. I turned to Mark and said, "Is this really happening? They kept that rule in for all these years?" Here's the funny thing about it. Somebody said, "Well, what would Glenn Sather have done?" I said, "Glenn wants to win. If there was no rule and they said, we're starting at 3-3, Glenn would have said, we're starting over. If they'd said, we're starting over, Glenn would have said, we're starting at 3-3. He'd look for any advantage he could get. The next morning, we flew to Edmonton at 9 a.m. We had a great practice. In the locker room, our attitude was, okay, we got one more game. Let's win. We took the game 6-3, but it turned out to be a wild one. The Bruins had no intention of rolling over, and they scored first. But once we had fought our way back into it, the fight started to leave them. I knew what that felt like. By the end, Andy Moog was left alone a little. The lopsided score wasn't his fault. It just goes to show how important desire and the will to win are to the game of hockey. If you come to the conclusion that you can't win, it's game over. In the end, we became the only team in NHL history to accomplish a 4-game sweep in 5 games. When we won the first cup in 84, it was chaotic. People were jumping on the ice. You couldn't move. It was out of control. By the 4th one, the fans wanted to sit back and take it all in. In those days, when you got the cup, you skated around the ice in a group. We didn't do what they do today. Give it to one guy who skates up and down, then passes it to the next guy. We just sort of passed it to each other in a pile. So when we were done skating with it, I looked around and saw that no one was left on the ice except the people from our team, the PR guys, the scouts, the extra players, the trainers, and the coaches. I thought, wow, we gotta get a picture. We pulled everyone together and I said, "Do you remember in the 60s when the Leafs and the Canadiens won the cup and they got a picture on the ice?" And everyone said, "Yeah, yeah, we gotta do this picture." The fans were great. They stayed in the stands cheering and taking pictures while we piled together on the ice and got a team picture. It's become a bit of a tradition. Every team that wins a cup now does a team picture on the ice. It's a pretty special picture for me, as it was my last time in an Oilers sweater. People always say the same thing. "Oh, you had it planned. You knew you were getting traded." I had no idea. My dad did, but he didn't tell me until later that night when he said, "You know what? You're gonna get traded." I was traded to the LA Kings that August. But Edmonton still had a strong core of players led by Mess and Kevin Lowe. Your best players, the core group, usually sort of carry the load. Normally, the core group is at their best somewhere between the ages of 23 and 28. In 1988, Mark was 26 and Kevin was 27. Edmonton was on top for a 12-year stretch because over that period of time, Glenn would tinker, as did Serge Savard or Scotty Bowman, with a couple of players to incorporate some new energy, new blood, and new excitement. But you can't switch up all your core players. Look at the success of, say, the Flyers in the 70s, or the Canadiens in the 70s. They didn't really mess with the core. Gordie Howe's GM in Detroit, Jack Adams, always said that a team can stay on top in hockey for 5 years and then things fall apart. I don't agree. I believe that you can go a good solid 10 years with a core group of players. In 1989 to 90, the Oilers made some changes in the lineup. Grant Fuhr missed the first 10 games with appendicitis, then hurt his shoulder. That opened the door for Bill Ranford. Glenn Sather traded Jimmy Carson, whom he'd gotten in my trade, to Detroit, along with Kevin McClelland, for Peter Klima, Adam Graves, Joe Murphy, and Jeff Sharples. The Oilers finished 5th overall, and Mess was 2nd in scoring in the league with 129 points. In the playoffs, the Oilers fell behind against the Jets, but won 3 in a row to move on. They swept us and knocked off Chicago, and then met the Bruins in the final. Game 1 of that series was the longest in Stanley Cup history. Peter Klima had been benched most of the game, so by the 3rd overtime, he was about the only player on either side not exhausted. He scored, and the Oilers took the series 4-1 for their 5th cup. Bill Ranford won the Conn Smythe for his outstanding goaltending through the playoffs. In 1991-92, the Oilers started to slip just a bit. Jari Kurri couldn't get the contract he wanted from Edmonton, so he played for HC Devils Milano in Italy for a year, and Grant Fuhr was out for 60 games. They were still good enough to beat the Flames in 7 games and us in 6, but then they lost to Minnesota. Minnesota had a great Cinderella run that year until they ran into Mario, Jagr, and Ron Francis with the Penguins. The next year, the Oilers traded Glenn Anderson and Grant Fuhr to Toronto. Steve Smith was traded to Chicago. Yari's rights were traded to Philadelphia. Charlie Huddy was claimed by Minnesota in the expansion draft, and Mess was traded to the Rangers, where he would eventually lead them to their first Stanley Cup in 54 years. The days of the Oilers dynasty were over. Chapter 35. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I don't know if we will ever see another dynasty like those Oilers teams. That's not boasting. I just think it is harder to build a team like that today than it was in 1979. There have definitely been some special teams since then, and the Detroit Red Wings came close. But league is different now. It is harder to win in today's NHL, if only because it's harder to make the playoffs. You see teams win the cup 1 year, then not even qualify the next. And when you have finally put together a winner, it's so much harder to keep that team together. The team that may be closest to dynasty status today is the Chicago Blackhawks. The Hawks have won 3 cups in 6 years, and even though they were out of the 2016 playoffs in the first round, they still have potential for more. Every time they lose a veteran due to salary cap pressures, they seem to find new stars. They lose goaltender Antti Niemi. They find Corey Crawford. They lose Patrick Sharp. They find Artemi Panarin. They lose Brandon Saad. They trade for Artem Anisimov and Andrew Ladd. With one of the strongest core groups ever, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane, Duncan Keith, and Brent Seabrook, they just keep winning, and all this under a salary cap. Chicago's general manager, Stan Bowman, is Scotty's son. He was always intrigued by Scotty's work, and when he was a kid, he'd sit close by and listen when Scotty was on the phone. Afterward, he'd say, "Why is this happening? What did that mean? Why did you say this?" Even before he went to college at Notre Dame to study finance and computer applications, he had a summer job as an assistant stock analyst. He'd sit in a room all day analyzing stuff. Stan really wanted a job in sports. So he sent his resume around to teams and players and got a response from the Blackhawks. GM Mike Smith had been a computer guy himself, and so in 2000, he brought Stan in as his Joe Boy. Stan ran around getting coffee, doing anything he could for Mike. Mike was fired in 2003 and replaced by Dale Tallon, who came to the team as a player in the 70s and had worked in the front office for years. Stan started working for Dale, advising him on regulations and bylaws. In July 2009, Dale was fired and Stan was promoted to GM. Some people want to get to the chase right away, but Stan likes to take his time. Knee-jerk, mid-season trades aren't his style. But in February 2016, Chicago's star right winger, Patrick Kane, had 64 points in 61 games, and then broke his clavicle after Florida's Alex Petrovic cross-checked him into the boards. It put him out for the rest of the season. Stan put Patrick on the long-term reserve list, which doesn't count against the cap. That gave him a couple of $1 million. Then he made a trade with the Coyotes. First-round draft pick and defenseman Klaas Dahlbeck for center Antoine Vermette. Vermette helped the Hawks win a cup, and then went back to Phoenix as a free agent. It was a win-win deal, and a lot like something Sam Pollock might do. There's so much more parity now because of the salary cap. The cap was the result of the 2004 NHL lockout. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, and this is what I admire about him, wanted every team, whether it's Ottawa or Phoenix, to be able to compete with Philadelphia, the Rangers, and Toronto. If you had 30 teams, but only 16 of them could make a lot of money, that would eliminate 14 teams. How would that grow the game? But now, thanks to the cap, you've got a chance to win a Stanley Cup no matter how big your market is. Before the cap, teams could spend as much as they wanted to keep a dynasty franchise together forever. But obviously that didn't happen. Going all the way back to the glory days of the Toronto Maple Leafs in the 60s, great teams were torn apart not necessarily over money, but over personalities. The Leafs had great players like Dave Keon, Tim Horton, Carl Brewer, and Johnny Bower in net. They also had Frank Mahovlich, one of the most gifted players of that era. Mahovlich was good enough to beat out Bobby Hull for Rookie of the Year. Mahovlich scored 48 goals in his fourth season, the most ever for a Leaf at that time, and a record that stood for 23 years. The Leafs won the Stanley Cup in 1962, and then before training camp in 1963, Mahovlich's contract came up for renewal. But he and Punch Imlach couldn't come to terms, and so Frank walked out of training camp. The Chicago Blackhawks heard about the dispute and offered the Leafs $1 million for Mahovlich, which made headlines. At first, Leafs co-owner Harold Ballard accepted the deal and a check for $1,000 as a deposit. But the next morning, ownership had second thoughts, and Ballard canceled it. The Leafs gave Mahovlich the contract he was looking for. But Punch Imlach never forgot what he saw as Mahovlich's act of disloyalty and disobedience. Imlach would constantly rag on him, telling him that he wasn't playing up to his potential. He'd mispronounce Mahovlich, put him down. He made Frank's life miserable. Things got so bad that in 1964, Mahovlich missed a month due to depression. Frank's doctor told him that his depression had a name. It was called Punch Imlach. Mahovlich led the Leafs in playoff scoring when they won the cup in 1964, and he was among the scoring leaders when they won again in 1967. But just before the playoffs on March 3, 1968, Imlach traded him to Detroit, along with Peter Stemkowski and Gary Unger, for Norm Ullman, Paul Henderson, and Floyd Smith. The deal also included rights to defenseman Carl Brewer, who didn't get along with Imlach either. He had been sitting out since 1965. In 1968 to 69, Mihajlović played on a line with Gordie Howe and Alex Delvecchio and scored 49 goals. He played a year and a half more in Detroit, and then was traded to Montreal, where he won two more Stanley Cups. Stafford Smythe fired Imlach at the end of the 1968 to 69 season, blaming him for depleting the team of player strength. Imlach said that someday he'd make Smythe eat his words. The next year, 1970, when Buffalo and Vancouver finally got expansion teams, Imlach was hired as the Sabres coach and GM. His first draft pick was future superstar Gilles Perreault. In 1975, Buffalo won the Prince of Wales Conference in the final game of the season by beating the Leafs. The Calgary Flames had a similar scenario in the 1980s. They were an incredibly strong team. GM Cliff Fletcher had started signing U.S. college players who'd slipped past the draft. He used some of those players to trade for Joey Mullen and Doug Gilmore out of St. Louis. Then he made some excellent draft picks. Joe Nieuwendyk, Gary Roberts, Håkon Lubb, Mike Vernon, defenseman Al McGinnis, and Gary Suter, and Theo Fleury, who was 166th overall. They were so loaded that they traded Brett Hull for depth on defense. With size, toughness, and character, Calgary went to the Cup Final in 86 and won the Cup in 89. If that team had stayed together, they would have continued to be contenders, maybe even a dynasty. But just like Frank Mihajlović in the 60s, Dougie Gilmore's contract was up, and he was looking for fair compensation. Even though Al McGinnis had won the Conn Smythe in their Stanley Cup year using his slap shot from the point to score 31 points, Dougie had made huge contributions as well. He scored two goals in the third period of the 89 final, helping the Flames become the first opposing team ever to win the Cup in the Montreal Forum. But Cliff Fletcher didn't want a big pay gap between players. He thought it was divisive. In the mid-1980s, the Flames' payroll was $5 million. It didn't matter if you were Kent Nielsen or Tim Hunter. Fletcher's philosophy was, I don't want to pay my top guys too high, and I don't want to pay my bottom guys too low. Then, in 1991, Fletcher moved to the Leafs, and Doug Risebrough replaced him as Calgary's GM. Risebrough had played with Yvonne Cornaway through four Stanley Cups, 1976 to 1979. And so he kept telling Dougie Gilmore that he wanted him to be his Cornaway. Gilmore told him that that was fine as long as he paid him like Cornaway. Negotiations were stalled. They were fighting over a $100,000 difference. After scoring a goal and an assist in an overtime win on New Year's Eve against Montreal, Dougie walked out the next day, January 1st, 1992. Risebrough had grown up in the Montreal Canadiens organization, and he was all about team loyalty. So he got on the phone with Cliff, and in the heat of the moment, they worked out a deal. Doug Gilmore, experienced defenseman Jamie McCowan, and Rick Natras, goaltender Rick Walmsley, and prospect Kent Manderville, would be traded for Gary Lehman, Craig Berube, defenseman Alexander Godinyuk, and Michel Petit, and goalie Jeff Reese. Lehman, who'd scored 51 goals two seasons earlier with the Leafs, struggled in Calgary. He scored just two goals in the rest of the 92 season, and then only nine the season after that. 11 goals in two seasons for Doug Gilmore, who had 200-point back-to-back seasons for the Leafs. That trade marked the beginning of a long decline for the Flames. Risebrough continued having trouble coming to terms with many of his players, including Al McGinnis, who went on to several great years in St. Louis and won an Olympic gold medal, Gary Suter, who was on the World Cup of Hockey winning team in 1996, and two U.S. silver medal Olympic teams, and Mike Vernon, who won another Stanley Cup with Detroit in 1997. Risebrough's estimation of their market value was very low. It got so bad negotiating with Vernon that the coach at the time, Dave King, went up to Doug's office and said, "Leave him alone. This is going to affect his play." The Flames didn't really turn it around until their 2004 Cinderella run to the Stanley Cup Finals. Meanwhile, Gilmore's arrival in Toronto had moved them from a team that missed the playoffs to a legitimate cup contender right away. One or two guys like Gilmore, the character guys, can change a franchise. Chicago found that in Jonathan Toews. Toews is the leader, the glue. Everyone knows his history and reputation for taking responsibility, how he plays, and what a good team guy he is. When he became captain of the Hawks at 20 years old, he was the third youngest captain in NHL history behind the Penguins' Sid Crosby and Tampa Bay's Vincent LeCavalier, who were both 19. Around Toews are guys like Brent Seabrook and Duncan Keith, who's a horse. He reminds me so much of Brian Leetch, who was one of the best players I ever played with. Brian was a guy who had the heart of a champion, and that's how Duncan plays. There's also Patrick Kane. We play in an era where everyone says you have to be big and fast. It's not that Kane isn't fast, but he's not the fastest guy out there, and he's not the biggest. What he's got is unique hockey sense. It's very special. I don't know if there's anything comparable. He's his own man. He can slow the game down to his pace, with all five opposing players skating his game, and then he'll shift to another gear. He's also got possibly the softest hands in the game. He does things with a puck I've never seen anybody do. Edmonton has Connor McDavid. He's already started to drive the bus and take all the pressure off the other guys. Teams can be great only if they have guys who allow them to be great. A great player can pioneer the trail. Orr, Howe, Béliveau, Richard, and hopefully McDavid. If you look at the Oilers trying to find their way, as they have for the last number of years, you see a lot of changes. Change the coach, change this, change that. All because there hasn't been growth. But I think we'll see more success now with McDavid at the center, along with guys like Darnell Nurse, who's a Kevin Lowe type, Oscar Klefbom, a solid D-man, their Charlie Huddy, Taylor Hall, who's like Glenn Anderson, and Jordan Eberle, who might be like Craig Simpson. In terms of his role and importance on the team, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins would be like any of our era's third-line centers, Mark Lamb or Kenny Linsemann. McDavid makes everybody around him better. He's a really bright kid. I'm told that players already look to him and that he deflects it in a humble way, which is all the more reason for his team to want to follow him. Players around a guy like that will evolve. A core player won't make them. After all, people are who they are. But that player's strengths will come out in those around him, and you build on that. The draft really is everything. It really is. It's so important. That's how you build the foundation of the team. Look at the 1980s Oilers draft picks. Messier, Anderson, Curry, Fuhr, Coffey. Montreal's 1975-76 Stanley Cup winning team was all draft picks except for Pete Mihaljevic, whom they got from Detroit. They were so deep, they basically had two teams. Today, because of the cap, a player's true value as a draft pick is maximized during development. That way a team can supplement their roster with players on entry-level contracts. If they're drafted high, your top six players have to be part of your overall roster, because the veteran guys who are carrying the majority of the baggage are $7, $8, or $9 million players. Drafting Patrick Kane, Connor McDavid, Steven Stamkos, and Taylor Hall, those aren't the hard picks. You know what you're getting. What really becomes important for a franchise is your second, third, and fourth round picks. Chris Chelios was a 1981 Montreal second rounder. Chicago picked up Duncan Keith second round in 2002. Colorado picked up Paul Stastny second round in 2005. Third rounders include Chris Letang, 2005, and Brad Marchand, 2006. Fourth and fifth rounders like James Reimer, 2006, and Jamie Benn, 2007, have to be able to jump in and be a big part of the success of that team. And then, of course, you get your steals. Dougie Gilmore was 134th in 1982. Luke Robitaille was 171st overall when Los Angeles picked him up in 1984. Jamie Benn was 129th for Dallas in 2007. Calgary's Johnny Gaudreau was 104th in 2011. And in the same year, Chicago's Andrew Shaw was 139th. I'll tell you a funny story about the draft. Pittsburgh Penguins GM Craig Patrick drafted Jaromir Jagr 5th overall at the 1990 draft in Vancouver. Four teams had passed on him before Patrick grabbed him, because Jagr had said he wasn't going to leave Czechoslovakia. He told the four teams who picked ahead that he was playing for his father's team in Kladno and didn't want to play in the NHL. But when the Penguins interviewed him, he said, "If you draft me, I'll come tomorrow." That was because he idolized Mario Lemieux and secretly wanted to play with him. That's another reason it's hard to build a dynasty today. Pittsburgh picked Jagr, but Jagr also picked Pittsburgh. And that is even more true with free agency. Guys want to go where they are going to have the most success. And who can blame them? Some teams just know how to win. And if I were a developing player, I would want to go where my hard work was going to be maximized. But the other side of that is that some franchises are going to find it hard to hold on to guys they have drafted and developed if they can't convince them it's in their best interest to stay. Chapter 36. I just love to play. In my early years in the NHL, I'd often sit with Bobby Hull, Gordie Howe, Phil Esposito, Guy Lafleur, and Jean Béliveau. They were very good to me, and I wanted to spend as much time as I could with them, socially, at the rink, in a restaurant, anywhere, so that they could pass on to me their beliefs about the road to personal success and to winning as a team. As a leader, Jean Béliveau was calm and focused, and he preached by example. A couple of years before he died in 2014, someone asked him how he wanted to be remembered, and he said, "I want to be remembered as a team player." That tells you a lot. He didn't say, "I want to be remembered as the guy who scored over 500 goals." There was no mention of his records. He wanted to be thought of as a team player. That's who he was. When I was in New York in 98, I got a message saying that the Rocket wanted to come see me before the game that night. At around 4:30 that afternoon, the trainer came in the room and said, "The Rocket's here." When I went out to meet him, he handed me a replica of the beautiful Maurice Richard trophy, which features a gold figure of the Rocket with his stick on the ice. That year, the NHL had donated the trophy to be awarded annually to the leading scorer. Maurice said, "Wayne, I know you're never going to win this trophy, but I want you to have one. You should have won it." To this day, it's the only trophy I have in my home. It sits on a bookshelf in our study next to the kitchen. You can't go anywhere in the house without seeing it. I recently had a wonderful dinner with Alex Ovechkin, who reminded me of me when I first met Gordie Howe. I'd asked Gordie 1,000 questions, just as Alex did. "How do you get ready? What do you eat before a game? What do you think of this guy? How many days a week do you practice?" In the old days, they used to say that if you don't win a Stanley Cup, you're not a Hall of Famer. Now it's tougher to win a cup. There are more teams, for one, and because of the salary cap, there's more parity. So in this day and age, you can make it into the hall without a cup, but it's an extra notch if you win it. Alex desperately wants to win a Stanley Cup. That's all he thinks about. That's all he cares about. I think that when most kids come into the NHL, they're in a sort of survival mode, just wanting to stay in the league. Then, as they start succeeding, their mindset changes to wanting to make a difference on their team, and from there it goes to wanting to win a championship. That's where Alex is now. We talked about what it takes to win, how special it is when you do, and how important it is to lift the Stanley Cup. Alex is a nice young man, and I have a great deal of fondness for him. I told him that when he gets to the final game and the chance to win the Stanley Cup, Janet and I will be there. I've had the opportunity for some quiet one-on-one sit-downs with other guys from the next generation. Hockey has changed. The game is different from what it was in the 80s, and in the 80s it was different from what it was in the 50s, but the players themselves haven't changed a whole lot. I still see the will to win, the intensity, the unselfishness, the sacrifices they make, and the best players playing at a higher level when it counts. None of that has changed. I've always carried with me something Gordie Howe told me at the 79 series against Moscow Dynamo. We were talking about what to expect, and Gordie said, "All you gotta do is just play the way you've always played. Get the puck to Mark and me and we'll be fine." 9 seconds into the game, Gordie got the puck and sent it to me. I gave it to Mark, Mark gave it to Gordie, and Gordie gave it back to me, and I scored. After the game, I said, "Gordie, oh my God, you really are that good." He said, "You know, Wayne, I just love to play. And if you love to play, good things happen." Mark Messier used to say, "There's not one thing about the game I don't love." I felt the same way. Going to practice, being in the locker room, sitting on the bench, playing big matchups. There were years when I played more than 130 games, preseason, the Canada Cup, the playoffs, and another 14 exhibition games. We played in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Cincinnati, places where they were trying to promote hockey. Mark Messier and I played every one of them because people were paying to come and see us. Someone might have saved up for a whole year or driven for hours to see us play. You had to put your best foot forward. What if it was some kid's first time at a game? My dad's mother, my grandmother Mary, took me to my first NHL game at Maple Leaf Gardens. I was 7, about to turn 8, and the Leafs were playing the Oakland Seals. On January 1st, 1969, my dad drove us down from Brantford to the Gardens in Toronto. He had a light blue Pontiac that chugged so much my stomach was in a knot the whole way. Would the car make it to the game, or would we break down and miss it altogether? He dropped us off in front and said, "I'll pick you guys up right here when it's over." I think he was nervous because I was so young and my grandmother was older. She would have been only 59. That's not very old to me now, but I remember looking up at her and thinking she was an old, old lady. Which is funny because I'm in my mid-50s now and have a grandson of my own. We were at the very top row in the gray seats, right across from the Seals bench, between the red line and the blue line, on the side where the TV cameras shoot Hockey Night in Canada. When the Leafs came on the ice for warm-up, I couldn't believe how blue their uniforms were. I'd only seen the games on black and white TV. Toronto had just won the cup 2 years earlier. They had Dave Keon, Ron Ellis, Norm Ullman, Paul Henderson, Murray Oliver, Bob Pulford, and Tim Horton. The Seals were in just their second year of expansion. So Toronto's shots on goal were almost double theirs. But to me, it was incredibly exciting. The final score was 7-3. My grandmother stood up to go and I said, "We can't leave. I gotta see the three stars." On TV, you just saw them skate up to the announcer. But in real life, they sat on the bench and skated out when their names were called. I think Ron Ellis was the first star, if I remember correctly. On the way out, I said to my grandmother, "That was the best night ever. I want to play hockey here someday." It was the first time I'd ever told anyone about wanting to be an NHL player. She looked down at me and nodded. "You're going to make it, Wayne. You'll see." This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 99 Stories of the Game by Wayne Gretzky with Kirsty McClellan Day. This program was directed by Arthur G. Insana. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2016 by Wayne Gretzky. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.